If you're listening to this, there's a good chance you work within the real estate investing industry. There's another good chance that you would like to increase the sales of your products or services.
Well, you're in the right place.
United States Real Estate Investor is a platform you need to place your brand directly in front of your target audience. With our focused, growing audience of real estate investing beginners, enthusiasts, and seasoned professionals, you can continually reach our captivated viewers and listeners with ease. To learn more or to get started today, just visit UnitedStatesRealEstateInvestor.com/advertising. That's UnitedStatesRealEstateInvestor.com/advertising. Get ready to increase your brand awareness and your bottom line. Attract clients with content.
Welcome to This Month in Real Estate Investing. In this episode, we'll be covering a variety of real estate investing news items, including Blackstone says time to buy real estate, real estate CEO sees decades of housing pain ahead, and $418 million settlement shocking real estate industry. Don't forget, you can join the live conversation with your thoughts and questions on Facebook and YouTube during the show. All this and more on this episode of This Month in Real Estate Investing. Let's start the show. I'm your host, James Brown, and I show people how to make safe, secure returns through our unique time-tested hybrid investing model. Go to hybridinvestor.vip to learn more and add the www if it doesn't pop up for you. Sometimes different browsers cause issues. So if you're watching live, feel free to comment and ask questions. Our guests today are Michael Margarella and Rick Hamrick. In that order, why don't you guys introduce yourselves and share your background, what types of investing you guys focus on?
For sure. Thanks for having us, James. Appreciate it. Yeah. As you mentioned, my name is Michael Margarella. I founded Next Play Investment, and we focus on bringing private equity to commercial real estate. So we focus specifically on multifamily and self-storage.
Oh, great. Cool. We have lots to talk about.
Very good. Yeah, I appreciate that. And thanks for the welcome, James and Michael. Thanks for preceding me. Rick Hamrick, I'm out of the Kansas City market, and I started in the real estate investing world in 2016 with my first buy and hold property. It was a long time W-2 earner, you know, working in the high-tech software sales world, technical sales engineering world, and started dabbling in the buy and hold realm and figured that I could do the marketing and acquisition better at a certain point. And in 2020, I stood up my own business in the Kansas City market doing just that, and quickly learned that I like the solution oriented side of real estate investing as well. So I focus strictly on pre-foreclosure and forced sale type of leads in the commercial and the residential market space. And then I also, at the beginning of 2023, founded a coaching mastermind that is specific to the forced sale, pre-foreclosure type of leads and being able to provide solutions where most can't.
Fantastic. Yeah, like we were talking before this started, we have a lot to talk about since I've got certifications in that space. Just kind of getting my feet wet. I'm working on helping somebody avoid foreclosure if at all possible. Right. So there's a lot to learn. So, but it's like you said, it's rewarding, and the creative side's really cool.
Right.
Well, thanks for being here, guys. Let's dive into the news. So from 8 News Now in Las Vegas, ridiculous rent increases leave Las Vegas tenants struggling to find affordable housing. That's where Antonio, our producer, is planning on moving. I don't know if there's going to be some opportunity based on that, but it's not looking good for renters. What did you guys think of this article?
I personally say that's a common theme, right? An affordability thing across the entire country. Anytime I'm working with or speaking with somebody, working in the local Kansas City market is one thing, but with our mastermind across the country, we're definitely talking to sellers across the entire country. You know, as people age and their earning potential goes down with the technical recession that's going on, with the inflation that's going on and everything else, affordability is not something that we're seeing any kind of easing on right now. So while the news article is specific to the Vegas area, I do see that theme across the entire country. And we've got to do something, you know, as a country about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we really need to get to the root cause of what's causing that. And there's a lot of factors, but I think two that are really important are the affordability of single family homes and the lack of new multifamily coming online. So as homes get less affordable, that's prices rising, that's interest rates rising, maybe that's prices not catching up with interest rates, that's forcing people to rent. And the more people that rent, whether it's A class, B class, C class, it's pushing other folks down the line, and it's causing rent increases throughout all the classes. So I think that's a big issue there. And I think the second issue, which is the lack of new multifamily, is really just because there's so few incentives for investors to develop. And the less development that comes online, the less supply there is. And of course, the less supply, the higher the demand and the higher the rent prices.
You hit on the real big problem there, is that investors aren't incentivized to get into affordable housing. Even with the band-aids, you know, there are some incentives, but it makes it, I don't think they're good enough incentives when there's other options where they can make more money, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you could always develop A-class real estate. It's not that much more expensive than developing working class products. Or you could always just purchase existing cash flowing or mismanaged real estate. And yeah, with the amount of time it takes to get through just city, county, state permitting, and the amount of money it costs developers nowadays, just rising construction costs and interest rates, it's just not advantageous to develop workforce housing.
Right. Yeah, much easier to do that. I'm in the same space as you also, besides we're in rent-to-own investing, but also raising money for syndicators, multifamily, self-storage. And it's just, yeah, if you're not having to deal with all the development side and the risks and stuff, just go buy something existing, turn around, add value to it. It's a much better play. Although that's a crowded space, so there's that, but it's not adding any extra units to relieve some of that pent up demand, right?
And it was pretty much the same way coming out of 2008, right? The home builders never really recovered in the same way, right? At the same rate, there are definitely less builders out there and taking action and building. Now, I do know that I just heard recent statistics that there are over 1 million new builds going on right now. But when you're talking about, you know, a $4-5 million unit deficit or housing deficit, that's not enough to actually make up for what we need, you know. So
right.
Combine that with just age and fixed incomes and what's gone on, you know, in the economy. I mean, we're literally at 35%+ since 2020, you know, with inflation and the cost of just day-to-day stuff, it makes it really tough. And as you said, it just kind of rolls downhill, right? You know, everything just gets passed along down to somebody. I mean, I just had to raise rents on one of my properties in the Kansas City market, and the tenant was none too happy. But, you know, they've been in the property for 18 months, and you're just like, what do you want me to do with the tax increase, the insurance increase? I mean, is that something that I just carry for you? Are you recession proof?
Yeah.
Or are you inflation proof, I should say?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Most people. Go ahead, Michael.
That's a really good point about the 1 million or so new developments that are in the pipeline. And that's something that Ken McElroy talks about frequently, is that there is some, reprieve in the pipeline here, in the immediate pipeline. But once you get past what's already in progress, he looks very closely at housing starts. So basically permits for new developments and things of that nature, things that would probably be 4, 5, 6 years down the road. And that is substantially down. So we're barely recovering from where we were post 2008, pre-COVID and post-COVID. And now once we get through that million that's in the pipeline, there's very little that's coming after that.
Yeah, we will see. Any other comments before we jump into the next one?
Well, it's good for the multifamily space.
Yeah, right.
You know, for folks who are buying existing multifamily, I mean, rents are increasing rather steadily. And even in some of the bigger markets like Austin and some places in Florida that had exponential rent growth in 2020 and 2021, their rent growth has flatlined. But when you look at it relative to what rent was in 2020, it's still up quite a bit.
Right. All right. From DIYer, House passes expanding access to Capital Act, broadens accredited investor definition. Just so people know, accredited investors have to have $1 million in net worth, not including their personal home, or more than $200,000 earned income in the past 2 years, or $300,000 if for a married couple, with the expectation that they're going to continue earning that. And then also financial professionals with a Series 7, 65, or 82 licenses also qualify. So they're looking at changing that, making it a little less stringent on being able to invest in deals that require an investor to be accredited. So I'm sure you guys are familiar with all that. I also just wanted to point out, I didn't really dive into this too much, but they were talking about, it's allowing clients clients of registered investment advisors with lower income or net worth, and it doesn't define that, to be able to invest in offerings up to 10% of their annual income or net assets. So are you guys familiar with this, or did you read into this anymore?
I'm personally not as familiar. I would assume Michael is more in the commercial space. I personally think that less restrictions are better, allowing people to do more of what they want with what they want. I mean, you know, in the beginning, having the caps of 10% is probably some good safeguards for it, because, you know, even when you get into some of, you know, the syndications and other things that are going on, people don't really fully understand what they're getting into. So this is less regulation I'm always for. And I think that this is a good thing, and kind of capping it and seeing how it goes will allow it to potentially expand in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, I generally agree with that. And we are familiar and have worked with both accredited and non-accredited investors. And really the difference comes into play depending on what the operator or how the operator chooses to operate the project, and whether that's a 506B or 506C offering. And from an operator's perspective, there are times where a 506C offering just makes more sense. It allows the operator to advertise to a wider audience, to folks that aren't necessarily friends and family. And that's attractive for a lot of operators. But the caveat there is that you're only permitted to accept accredited investors. So I agree. I think this legislation is a good thing. I think investors should be able to choose where they invest their money. And I don't think it's necessarily fair for the government to say that only quote unquote wealthier or well-off individuals are allowed access to accredited investments. Sometimes those investments are really solid ways to build wealth. And I think more Americans should have access to that.
I agree 100%. And I get where these rules come from, you know, protecting people from losing their life savings or whatever, because they're just uninformed. That, you know, on our side as money raisers and operators of these kinds of deals, it's definitely up to us to be ethical and educate anybody, especially those non-accredited investors, on what these deals are, how to make a good decision, because there's a lot of deals out there. Some may or may not be good. And that's like what we do. We vet operators on behalf of our investors, so we know who are good operators, and then really dive into the deals themselves and do due diligence on those deals with a team of people that know what they're doing. And then, so there's this added layer of due diligence to help protect whether those investors are accredited or unaccredited. So,
well, that's a great structure. And I think that's more important than the distinction between accredited and non-accredited is really due diligence. That's what you hit on, and doing the proper due diligence. And I don't think necessarily that an accredited person is more likely to do the proper due diligence. I think any person who's working with someone like yourself is more likely to do that due diligence. And in my opinion, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head is doing due diligence on the operator. I'm a big proponent of it's the jockey, not the horse. And I'd much prefer to be in a deal with a better operator than not. And I think doing due diligence on the operator's history, prior performance, their boots on the ground team, property management teams, those are all really important things that I think a lot of investors wouldn't necessarily think of if it was their first investment.
Yeah. Yeah, with the way we do it, you know, there's a very famous syndicator out there. Keep it this person unnamed, but there's rumors, I'd say, based on real facts, that this is not a good operator, but very well known, you know. So having that extra layer of people like really hammering and asking the hard questions revealed that. So now we're like, whoa, okay, I guess we'll keep our investors away. So yeah. All right. Well, hey, let's jump to the next news from Business Insider, America's Hidden Homes. They're talking about steering. If anybody's familiar with that term as a licensed agent, it's basically steering clients one way or another, possibly away from homes for sale based on the commissions that are offered. If there's a low commission offered, a buyer agent may steer somebody away from that because they're not getting paid as much. I could talk a lot about this, and we have another article too that's talking about the NAR lawsuit that we can get into a little bit more. But you guys want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, that I'm not a licensed agent, but you know, I've bought many and sold many homes over the years, and maybe it's just because of, you know, the business background or whatever it may be. I've always considered anything with the real estate agents as negotiable, right? And I do remember in reading inside of contracts that these rates were the rates or standard rates or these marketing fees were just what we do. And I would always go back and push back. Now, is that the majority of the country? No way, right? You know, and when you start talking about, you know, the ability to negotiate those rates as kind of as an unknown for a majority of folks, they wouldn't even know that their buyer's agent or somebody that they're working with could potentially be steering. Now, with the prevalence of technology and how it's really exploded over the last 10 years, when I look back to the early 2000s buying my first house, it was, I was wholly dependent on what that real estate agent sent me about the houses that were listed. But in today's day and age, I think a lot of buyers can leverage the technology, the Redfins, the, you know, the Zillows and other platforms that are out there to help them see things that maybe they aren't getting on their daily list from their agent. But it is problematic for the majority of folks who aren't paying that much attention to it and not buying and selling homes on a regular basis. And they might unknowingly be passing up a perfectly good house or the house that they're actually looking for because the agent is saying, well, I won't make as much. I'm only going to make a percent or nothing's listed or 2.5% instead of 3%. And that becomes definitely problematic. And when you start talking about any of the news articles that we've talked about or we will talk about today, one of the things that is near and dear to us as ethical operators is doing the right thing and really acting as a fiduciary for anybody that we're representing, whether it be a borrower direct or another investor that we're working with or whoever it may be. So I think the hidden homes thing is I've probably seen it less just because I know what I'm looking for, but I have to assume that it's a very real practice and has gone on for a long time.
Yeah. Michael, did you have anything on that?
Yeah, it's certainly unfortunate to hear, and you'd like to think over the long term, the market would start to weed out some of those agents. And, you know, as you mentioned, just home buyers having more access to things like Redfin and Zillow will hopefully improve things. I don't necessarily think government regulation is the way to go, but I do think home buyers having a bit more knowledge about exactly what you said about everything is negotiable and just taking that to the negotiating table when they're working with an agent.
Yeah, you know, something that was in this summary here says commissions have remained stubbornly fixed between 5% and 6%. Oh my God. The narrative that the news outlets kind of layer onto this is just frustrating because commissions have never been fixed. It's always negotiable. Now, the seller in the past or up till July when this shakes out with this NAR settlement, the sellers could choose to offer a certain amount to a buyer agent. That wasn't seen, like no one knew behind the scenes what was being offered except for the agents. And that's where the agents were being able to see that and steering people away if they chose to. That's just kind of a little background. So that's going away, that published, privately published between agents amount. Now it's going to be negotiable kind of during the contract phase. But we could go down a rabbit hole here, but without a seller offering that buyer agent commission, the buyer agent is going to have to either get that from the buyer who's already putting down a down payment and covering closing costs and probably barely able to buy, especially first-time home buyers. Now that's going to be a negotiation between the buyer agent and that client. And then when they go make offers to a seller, there's going to be some negotiation with that seller and seller agent to hopefully cover some of that. So I don't know if that was confusing or not, especially probably is if you're not deep in this world as a licensed agent in that negotiating, but, anyway, yeah, there's a lot of misinformation and kind of half truths and kind of scare tactics in the news. Which is why I love this show, that we can kind of dive into that and clear some things up. So, any other things to add to that?
No, I think we'll probably get into it a little bit more with the NAR article as well. Yeah. I think we're going down the right path as far as that's concerned.
Yeah. You know, transparency is good. So I think we're heading in the right direction. Although it's just kind of weird the way it's kind of shaken out. But anyway, just hope it doesn't hurt buyers as much as it seems like it may. Anyway, all right, we'll table that for now. So the next article is from Bloomberg via Yahoo Finance. Blackstone says time to buy real estate as prices at bottom. So John Gray from Blackstone is advising to buy. If anybody is unaware, Blackstone, let's see, what are they? They have like 100 or 1 trillion in assets. So they own a lot of real estate.
I don't know if I agree that prices have bottomed. I think, right. especially if we start to see some rate decreases, which the Fed hinted at in late 2023 and haven't come to fruition yet. But if we do see that in 2024, 2025, I think prices are just going to, I think it's going to have a huge impact on prices. But with that being said, I agree with the tone of the sentiment. I think the best time to buy real estate was yesterday and the next best is today. So I don't necessarily think you could go wrong so long as you do your due diligence and you work with a solid team. It's tough to time the market, whether we're talking prices or interest rates. So in my opinion, I agree with the sentiment of the article. I think now is a good time to buy real estate.
Yeah, I definitely agree with anytime, as long as you're doing your due diligence and the numbers work, it is the right time, whether it's retail or in an investment. I don't think that we've hit the bottom, and I don't think that even if rates come down, we will see this huge springboard of inventory come out, right? It's the lack of inventory and the difference between the 2.5% rates and the potential 7.5% rates that are just keeping people on the sidelines, whether you're an investor or a retail buyer. And that doesn't necessarily make sense as long as the asset is right and the numbers are right. I do believe, right, that inventory is going to go up. We work closely with banks and institutions. I mean, that's who we're negotiating with directly on a daily basis and talking to loss mitigation departments and talking to the credit departments and everything else. We are being told on a daily basis that they haven't been this busy since 2010, right? So when you've got all of the economic factors that are going on since 2020, all of that is basically coming to a head. And we've actually seen the servicers and the investors behind the loans that are 30 plus days behind or 90 days behind being a bit more aggressive in 2024 than they were historically. I think in between 2020 and 2023, everybody was watching to see what the government was going to do, who's going to bail us out, who's going to do these type of things. And I really, and having a tremendous amount of conversations with institutions in 2023, think that they were kind of giving us the same thing, just kind of sitting on the sidelines and waiting. And when they didn't get any kind of huge potential bailout, there are things going on, right, with the foreclosure stops on owner-occupied VA loans, that started in November of 2023 that are good through May. There's definitely things like that going on, but not quite to the extent that they had hoped. So I think they're being a lot more aggressive in 2024 with foreclosure starts and actually trying to get some of these through the pipeline because they know what's coming.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Okay, let's take a break to learn about one of our sponsors.
Attention investors, are you happy with your current returns? Would you be interested in a safe, secure, low-risk, high-return investment in real estate? And what if you never had to deal with another rehab, bad tenant, or lousy property manager? Introducing an innovative investing approach that gives new and sophisticated investors a higher ROI with more protection than traditional methods. We've created a blue ocean investing strategy by combining the tried and true models of fix and flip with buy and hold, and have found a way to keep the benefits of both while eliminating the drawbacks. Hybrid real estate investing is a better way to invest that allows busy professionals to replace their salary, build passive wealth, reap huge tax benefits, and fund their retirement with income-producing real estate without the usual risks and headaches. HybridRealEstateInvesting.com. the best risk-adjusted returns in single-family real estate.
All right. That was my business partner, Toby, reading that. Let's jump back into it. From Where News 3, Florida lawmakers pass bill to revoke squatters' rights, protect property owners. So they're changing some things up to eliminate these squatters. Property owners can enlist the sheriff's office to get rid of squatters by filing an affidavit to prove ownership. Sounds pretty straightforward.
As any logical person would say, I mean, exactly right. It sounds straightforward as it can be, and it makes a tremendous amount of sense. I'm glad somebody hopefully is leading the way and that propagates around the country, but I'm not so sure that it actually will, right? In the Kansas City market alone, it is funny how powerful the tenants' unions are becoming, and the regulations that are being pushed down on, you know, not only the large, right, landlords that own 40,000 households, but the small business owners that are doing right, doing things ethically. Just the one size fits all model just doesn't really work. And when you listen to the squatters' rights and the way those have just kind of gone about across the country, you know, what I would say a reasonable person would just scratch their head and say, well, what do you mean? It's your house and these people don't have a lease and they don't have an agreement and they haven't purchased it, but you can't kick them out of your house, right? Yeah. You know, it doesn't make any sense. So I think hopefully it becomes a trend and that this is something, you know, Florida leading the way that others follow, because I think it's been a big issue across the country for people trying to provide good quality housing for all of our citizens.
Yeah. Yeah. It says previously squatters were treated as tenants under the law. that's insanity. There's no contract. Like, get them the hell out of there. In fact, speaking of that, we did have one of our rent to own deals where somebody ended up in the property squatting. Long story how this guy got in there. We knew him. It wasn't just like, oh, he just showed up. But, you know, we hired an attorney, Florida attorney, that got him out of there, got the sheriff over there, you know, posted things and got him out of there pretty quick, actually, within 30 days. I don't know how much of that had to do with having a good attorney, but like this was during COVID issues where it was kind of like you couldn't get anybody out, you know, or at least you couldn't easily evict somebody, you know, through the regular eviction process. But anyway, Michael, you got anything on that?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think it's a good thing for the real estate industry. I think in line with what we were talking about with development, I think this is sort of an indirect nudge to perhaps get some new real estate investors in the market or keep some existing real estate investors in the market longer by easing the burden of displacing a squatter. So I think anytime you could give incentives for people to provide affordable housing, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Antonio's got a comment in here. It says the owner of the property got arrested from inside her own property in front of the squatters due to her needing to go through the proper court process. I'm wondering if she was being foreclosed on and getting kicked out, but there was also squatters.
You know, I'm guessing that it was a tenant, you know, in the property, or not even a tenant, right? Just a squatter. We call those professional tenants, right? People who know how to go from one place to one place and work the system and use the rules and the regulations and guidelines against the true owner. Sounds to me like a situation
on their record.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And nobody knows what they've actually done over all these years. It's just somebody who knows how to work the system, essentially. And the true owner of the property is standing in the living room, but violating the tenant rights and getting arrested themselves. Right. That, I think, is what he's talking about.
Oh, OK.
Yeah. My guess is there some unauthorized entry into somebody else's home.
Right.
Yeah. It's crazy. The other thing that they say in that article is that, you know, some of these people will also attempt to sell or lease while they're squatting. Mm-hmm. You know, they put it on online, get a down payment or, you know, a security deposit, and it's not the owner, it's some squatter or.
And this underscores, you know, another point that we spoke about earlier, that this is some feedback that I hear often from investors as to why certain things are risky or not risky. And so if we could do more things to regulate that and mitigate that risk, I think it's just going to bring more folks to the market. And I think that's going to increase supply. And I think eventually that's going to help level off rents. So I think, again, this really comes down to due diligence and what processes. I mean, look, you can't eliminate the possibility of a squatter, but I think there's some due diligence that you can do along with your property management team to help mitigate that. And so, again, I think that just underscores the importance of that due diligence process as well.
Yeah. All right. Next article, New York Post. New York City realtors pull out new trick as $15 congestion pricing is set to take its toll on motorists. So what? I hadn't heard about this till now. They're talking about charging anybody entering Midtown, south of 60th Street, $15 to drive into that area. And so these agents are marketing properties that are outside that area, saying, hey, can avoid paying that price. So
yeah, without getting too into the weeds as to the rationale behind the legislation, which I think is multifaceted from an environmental perspective, perhaps a tax grab perspective, and a whole lot of other reasons. I think as far as real estate goes, I don't see this having a huge impact on real estate in Manhattan. I think very few, at least relative to other metros, very few New Yorkers that live in Manhattan own a car. So I don't think it's going to have a huge impact on a person wanting to live north of 60th Street, let's say. I think this legislation is more geared towards commuters and folks who are driving during certain times of the day. So my guess is it's not going to have a huge impact on where a homeowner chooses to live or whether, you know, one block north or south is a huge value add.
Yeah. Well, my immediate thought was like, you know, taxis and delivery services where they have to go in and out. They're going to get dinged $15 every time. So that's going to cause the cost of things to go up. So
I just saw a related article. Yeah. That they're considering some carve outs for certain services and industries. And I don't know if those would fall under those. Certainly hope so, because that would not be fair.
Yeah. Yeah, it says they're looking at raising $1 billion annually for MTA, the transportation group there. Maybe. Right? You always wonder. You know. Oh, yeah. Who knows where that money ends up going? Probably not all of that to the transportation group. Let's see.
Yeah. And I tend to doubt this is really going to keep anybody off the road. You know, but we'll see.
Yeah. I actually went to Manhattan for the first time this fall. I had never been there. I was like, I got to go check it out. Wow. That is an impressive, interesting city for anybody that hasn't been there. I was like, I'm an American. I need to go to New York City and actually see it in person. It was quite a trip.
I didn't get that.
Oops.
Could you try again?
Oh, Alexa, I thought I was talking to her. All right. From Fortune via Yahoo Finance, top real estate CEO sees decades of housing pain again. What the Fed did will have a 30-year tail on it, quote unquote. This is from the Redfin CEO, Glenn Kelman, talking about how interest rate hikes aim to combat inflation have kind of upset things. So any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously, I think the face of real estate changed in 2020, right? When we were at a certain point of that market run up from, you know, 2010 all the way to 2020, we were starting to see maybe some sort of a normalized, you know, market, pre-foreclosure market in 2019, and those were up. And then as soon as 2020 hit, when you have the federal government telling people to not leave their house, not go to work, not pay their rent, not pay their mortgage, injecting trillions of dollars into the economy, where you had people that were actually making more staying home than they were at their regular, you know, hourly job, that there's going to be some kind of fallout and some kind of ramification to it. So we were already at historical low interest rates. And then when you're putting that type of injection into the economy and making others foot the bill, there has to be some sort of fallout from that, right? And we are on that doorstep, right? Or I should say we're on that doorstep. While a lot of people were potentially flat or even potentially going down as a retail real estate agent or as a traditional investor, we were doing nothing but this, right? More and more opportunity coming our way. So by the you know, I hate to kind of knock it, right? Like I think real estate is largely, you know, between the ears. And that was the same in 2008. You know, it's all what you believe and how you take action and how you do your numbers and everything else. But for the majority of this country and this population, the news that's consumed and the information that comes in, whether it's through a social media platform or through your traditional news, is telling them one thing. Kind of going back to what you were talking about on the change in commissions and some of the media hype and some of the media narrative that isn't quite right. Those are the things that a majority of this country are not aware of. You know, that a lot of us that are a lot closer to the day-to-day action are. So I definitely think that with the interest rates and with inflation and everything else that's going on with, you know, the home building and the lack of inventory and everything else, it is going to take potentially decades for the real estate market to correct itself. But that doesn't mean you don't operate in that market. You just adapt to the market.
Yeah, there's so much there in that article. And I think going back to the supply and demand influx that we spoke about earlier, so many homeowners refinanced in 2020, 2021, 2022, even when rates were sub 3%. And so those folks, it's going to take a lot for them to move and to accept a 7% plus interest rate or whatever we end up being in 2024. So we still have that imbalance there and the new construction starts that we spoke about earlier. So I think in all likelihood rates will normalize, but it's anybody's guess as to when, whether that's in 2025 or thereafter. But I think as that happens, we'll start to see a bit more supply come on market. I think from an investment standpoint, just like Rick said, you have to adapt and you have to figure out, well, what's the strategy now moving forward? And I think even at today's interest rate, if a project works for you at call it 7%, and so long as you're avoiding bridge debt, you're probably in pretty good shape, because if rates increase, you're going to be happy that you get that 7% rate. And if rates decrease, you could always look to modify or refinance your loan down the road. So I think you just have to hone in on your strategy and your focus and figure out the next path forward for the company.
Yeah. Inventory is just going to naturally increase. You know, Michael made reference to the 2.5% rates. You know, we had that boom, the real estate boom, when people were like, oh, you mean I don't have to come into the office? I can move to the suburbs. I don't have to commute. I don't have to do any of this type of stuff. You bring that type of money, especially like city type money, into the suburbs, people are overpaying for real estate. I mean, the things that we were seeing, you know, $50,000 over asking price with no contingencies, waiving all inspections and doing that type of stuff. And a lot of those being cash transactions from those that come from bigger cities or bigger states into more rural areas. You had a bunch of people that were first-time home buyers buying at 2.5% or 3% that, you know, were always told, hey, you should go buy a house. You know, your mortgage is fixed. You don't have to worry about rate increases, you know, on rents and that type of stuff. But what everybody forgets is the TI portion of the PITI, right? And what we've seen since 2020 with the taxes, with the insurance and everything else, I've got this beautiful 2.5% rate on my property. But for some reason, my monthly expenses have gone up $500, $600, $700, $800 or more a month. And the reality of it is that over 60% of this country live paycheck to paycheck. And when you start talking about a monthly increase in expenses of $500, $600, $700, $800 a month, which to us as entrepreneurs or business owners, we're like, well, hey, if something changes in the economy, I'll just go get an extra deal. I'll go do this. I'll go do that. I'll make up for it. But what we can't neglect to remember is seniors on retirement income or fixed income or people that are working their W-2 jobs that don't necessarily have that mentality. They're the ones that are in the real trouble. And those, you know, so we're seeing a bunch of properties that were purchased in the last couple of years that are already hitting that that foreclosure start, right? 90 plus days delinquent. So, and that's what we focus on is that notice of default or that notice of list pendants. And we're seeing that increase steadily.
Yeah. And even on the commercial side, you know, I think there's certainly some pain on the financing side. It's more difficult now to obtain commercial financing than it was a few years ago. And I think for new investors or investors looking to transact on the commercial side the next couple of years, having relationships with your lender is going to be super key, because there's some level of fear that I've certainly sensed with lenders in the past year, let's call it. And even if deals are penciling, they're just not as interested in working with people who don't have a particular subset of experience or a relationship with that bank.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, so I think that commercial is going to be the bigger story over the next 4 to 6 years than residential. I mean, residential is going to see its blip. It's going to be nothing like the great financial crisis of 2008. I think everything's going to go up. But commercial obviously is particularly hard when you start talking about, you know, the brick and mortar, when you start talking about the office space, when companies are locked into a 2, 3, 4 year lease, but then realize that we don't need $100,000 or 100,000 square feet of office space. We can get away in this hybrid model with only having 40,000 square feet. We're seeing a lot on the commercial side where the, you know, the it's, you know, only got 40%, 50% occupancy, right? So the commercial assets. And when you're talking about the banks and the institutions, especially the smaller ones that potentially loan on these type of deals, they're going to be a lot more risk adverse and a lot, you know, a lot more worried about what could potentially happen with the economy over the next few years. Because think about taking a house back. That's one thing. And any bank or institutions do a terrible job of owning any asset because they're in the business of lending money, making money on money, right? These are the institutions that are literally paying, you know, $200 a week to mow a lawn when it should only be, you know, $30 or $40. They just don't do it. It's not their business. But if you are in the commercial space and you're holding an $18 or $20 million loan, and people, there are big, huge institutions that are strategically defaulting and walking away from commercial loans. And if you are that smaller or mid-sized institution that is holding that loan, you don't want that property back. You'll do anything to not take that property back, because all of a sudden you become responsible for the tax liability or any of the other things. And that can shut a bank down in a second if they have to pay millions in tax or insurance or on any kind of asset that they actually take back. So it'd be really interesting to see how the commercial market goes over the next 4 to 6 years. But I think we're going to see a major change in that, and potentially a lot of repurposing of some of these spaces, office spaces and mixed use spaces, for sure. Got to get creative with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Every month we have something along those lines that we're talking about. One of the articles, I don't know if it's one coming up, I saw a little comment that some of these banks, because they don't want those properties back, they're backing off on some of their terms of their loans, maybe not making people refinance into those higher loans from their floating rate debt. Just they're like, they don't want
to. Or they're selling, right? They're selling a non-performing loan, right? Trying to get out from under it with whatever right. they can. I mean, we're seeing that literally. This is an election year, right? And if you just do any kind of searches on Fannie selling off non-performing and re-performing loans, and a lot of these institutions, especially the government-backed institutions, are selling those off at 30, 40, 50 cents on the dollar, so that they don't have to be, the government doesn't have to be the one foreclosing or doing that type of action. We mentioned the VAs, VA doing a moratorium on foreclosure starts for owner-occupied again, right? This is the second time in the last 3 years that the VA has done a moratorium on foreclosures. And you got to wonder, there's a reason. They're seeing something that the rest of the media is not portraying, that your federal government is not portraying. But as my partner always says, beavers don't build dams in the middle of a desert. So why is the VA stopping something? And that stops at the end of May, right? So June the 1st, foreclosure starts can kind of kick back in, and you're going to see a lot of non-performing assets. And I think even in the Blackstone one, they reference potentially taking over a $17 billion portfolio, right? Yeah. Because the banks don't want to hang on to those assets, because that's just not their gig. They make money from lending money. So they'd rather recuperate that money as quickly as they can and move on with their life. They've got their own KPIs. They understand they're going to write so much off, and such is life in their world.
Yeah, I think what the banks are going to do in the commercial space is going to be super interesting in the next few years here, because there's so much floating debt that's maturing or has matured in the last year. And with rates now double what they were when those loans were originated, those assets just aren't affordable. They're not going to hit the debt service coverage ratios that they hit at origination, and they're not going to meet the bank's underwriting practices now. But to Rick's point, the banks don't necessarily want them on their books. The assets might not even be worth the debt. So what do you do? And so I've heard in the space that some banks are starting to make some exceptions, right? They're elongating the term, or they're modifying the loan. That can't be done in every instance. We've heard some big foreclosures in the news in the commercial space. So I don't know what's going to be the large scale answer for these banks. Is it going to be a case by case analysis? That's where I lean. But we'll see. I think also it's important to kind of separate out, when we're talking commercial, office from pretty much everything else, because I agree. I mean, I think office is in a really tough situation, and I really don't know what the future is of office. But I think some other asset classes that we've spoken about earlier, so multifamily, self-storage, I mean, we talked about rent increasing here over the last couple of years, and even in 2024. So I think those are assets that are well positioned, and I think those are assets where banks are more likely to make exceptions. At least those are some of the exceptions that I've heard, where they're seeing the business plan being executed, they're seeing rents increase, and really at no fault of the operator, the debt service coverage ratio just doesn't work anymore. So I think in certain scenarios, we could see banks make exceptions and give the operator another year or two to see if they could keep increasing the net operating income, or see if just interest rates level.
Yeah. And they'll also go to the government and ask for a bailout. Right. a couple more comments, and we should probably get to the next item. But in this article, it talks about disrupting the once common low rate environment. Like, yeah, if you looked at a couple of years where it was super low, but it's not real common. Then here's a post that I just reposted. In 1971, the interest rate was 7.33%. If you had waited for rates to drop, you wouldn't have bought a home until 1993. 1971 to 1993. You would have rented for 22 years while you waited for rates to go down, while house values quadrupled. That's interesting data, We'll see where things go. But those were very nice low rates there. We'll see.
Yeah. No, I think the first personal house I bought was somewhere around 6.75%, mm-hmm. you know, so it, you know, having kind of ridden the early 2000s to today, when people are like, you know, the historically low rates, I guess we start thinking in generations by every 20 years or so. But to that article's point, you know, you're literally saying you would have been renting for 22 years on a potential 30-year mortgage where the actual value of the property quadrupled, right? It just becomes the right asset with the right numbers at the right time. And, you know, obviously the, you know, the traditional homeowner has kind of moved away, or there's less homeownership, you know, when you start talking about millennials and some of the other generations, you know, as they've come to realizing what they want to do or the lifestyle that they want to have or live. But at the end of the day, owning something, I think, you know, again, this is just my opinion, owning something and taking advantage of the appreciation and all of the benefits of actually owning that, unless you're in a complete and total war zone, 20 years from now, pretty much any real estate that you own is going to be worth more.
Yeah. And one thing I like to point out too is there's a difference between 7%. Maybe rates go to 20%, but if you're renting, your interest rate is 100%.
Right.
So, yeah. But you talk about depreciation and the other benefits, tax write-offs, those equal out, especially after a couple of years when you start paying down your loan. The numbers are staggering when you don't own versus renting. So, all right, next news item from Benzinga. U.S. can use billions in unspent COVID aid to help ease the housing crisis. So they're talking about reallocating some money that maybe wasn't necessarily allocated for housing. So let's see, it was $40 billion of the $350 billion initially allocated for state and local fiscal recovery funds are still available. So they're talking about expanding housing access beyond those earning up to 65% of the area's median income, and then now including individuals making up to 120%.
So. Right. Yeah. I mean, obviously, that's money that's been earmarked or set aside for some type of relief. I'm happy for it to move into the housing world just because of what we've talked about over several of these articles, right? You know, with the lack of inventory, the lack of units, the affordability issues with it, increasing from 65 to 120%, making home ownership more accessible. In theory, right? When it comes back to, well, why do we have, you know, this much excess funds left over? And I don't want to sound like I bash on the federal government, but anytime that they're involved, it's never traditionally worked out well in the long run, right? When you start talking about the red tape and when you start talking about the bureaucracy and who gets this, and then you always learn about, you know, 10, 15 years later, the pay-to-play schemes and all of that. So I think that that earmarking and redirecting some of this to some good programs that, you know, HUD can put on and others is a great intent. The execution of it is really what I question in it.
Yeah. It's always this aim, this goal, and then it's like, yeah, it didn't quite hit, but yeah, we'll see. It also mentioned $5 billion. Allocated to creating affordable apartments. So,
it's a great thing.
Yeah. Well, hey, let's take another break for our next sponsor.
Are you looking to elevate your business through exceptional content? Universe Media Publishing is your gateway to success. We understand that in the world of business, content is king, but not just any content. Your business deserves content that captivates, convinces, and converts your audience into clients. At Universe Media Publishing, we specialize in crafting SEO-rich web content, persuasive copywriting, and marketing copy that resonates with your audience. We don't just write, we engage, we connect, and we deliver results. Imagine your brand's voice amplified, your message crystal clear, and your presence dominating the digital landscape. That's the power of partnering with Universe Media Publishing. Don't let your business just blend in. Stand out, be heard, and make an impact. Connect with us at Universe Media Publishing, and let's turn your vision into reality. Visit universemediapublishing.com today. Your story, our expertise. Together, we'll create magic.
Okay, back to the show. From Business Insider, two reasons why the South will stay the hottest housing market in the U.S. They mention strong employment trends and relative affordability. Florida comes up quite a bit, and the South just in general in this show. Rick, do you have any experience or comment?
Yeah, I think that obviously that's true, and it's going to be true for a while. I'm not hyperly aware of all of the details, right, of Idaho, right? Remember, Idaho was pretty hot for a while. You had a lot of people from California and other areas of the country relocating to Idaho. And then, of course, you see all the signs of people saying, hey, leave, go back, go home, go away, right? Anytime you have a mass migration into the great state of Texas, and especially in the Austin area, but anywhere where the business environment is more inviting, you know, no state income taxes and very pro-business and business-friendly with a little bit less regulations and guideline on doing something, it makes sense. Let's move into, hey, you know what? Florida just got rid of the squatter's rights. You know, this is going to be a place I want to go to do business. You know, all of that changes anyway over time, right? To basically handle the influx of that migration. So at some point, maybe state income taxes are going to become necessary in the state of Texas to just keep up with the infrastructure demands or anything else that is going on in the. So I think real estate is hyper local, and I think that it also goes in cycles and goes in waves. So at a certain point, what is going on right now with those being hot areas will definitely start to taper just by the sheer influx of people, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They mentioned in that article exactly what you said. They're going to have to probably bump up their taxes, and there's going to be some calming down of that growth, obviously. The prices have gone up, so... There's sure.
And I mean, Texas and Florida are both being hammered right now with insurance issues and carrier issues and everything else, right? So that, you know, obviously the regulators are working on trying to fix and bring in additional insurance carriers and others. But because, you know, Florida obviously is in the wetlands of Hurricane Alley and everything else, that's one thing. And then you get into Texas, and that's where the hail damage and the storms and the tornadoes and I reside, you know, on the Kansas side of Kansas City. Kansas is also a pretty high interest or increase in insurance and everything else. So all of these different factors, based on all of these different weather events, these migration patterns will obviously change the face of real estate, whether it's commercial or residential in any of these states, right? And it just becomes, how do we adapt to doing, you know, business in each of those states. But I do think that those are inviting states right now, but at a certain point, the invitation of, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s of California or New York kind of wanes off and goes away, and they run into their own issues, right? So we'll see that, you know, in the South as well.
Yep. All right, from Business Insider, risky commercial real estate investments are getting squeezed as the market collapses. We already kind of touched on this.
Yeah, common thread, I think, you know, with a lot of these different articles and you know, as Antonio mentioned, right, commercial real estate is talked about a lot because I think for most investors, you know, or people that are getting into real estate investing, your mindset always goes to residential. Mm-hmm. You forget about the other asset classes that you can potentially invest in. And This one, when you actually take a look at this risky commercial real estate investments, is basically talking about the, you know, the collateralized loan obligations, right? And that's a subset and an indicator or a pre-indicator for the commercial space. And when you actually take a look at the increase in 30-day plus lates on these assets, I mean, it's gone from somewhere in the range of 1.8% all the way up to, I think, in January of 2024 to over 8%, right? So, I mean, when you're looking at a graph, it literally just shoots up pretty hard over the last, you know, 5 or 6 months. And any of these type of things are indicators. One of the markets that I watch quite a bit to kind of give me some insight into what's going to happen in the real estate world is the auto industry. Mm-hmm. What is going on right now with auto loan defaults, with auto loan repossessions, with that crazy 2020 to 2023 period where dealers could charge you, you know, $10,000 over invoice and you'd just pay it, right? Yeah. They'd be taking you over the coals. And now with the interest rates, you know, in the 10% range, depending on your credit, you know, on new car purchases and used car purchases, dealers are sitting on potentially sometimes, you know, 350 days of inventory for particular vehicles. And so they're starting to really feel the pinch and the pain. And the auto industry is usually a precursor to what's going on, you know, in the real estate market. And we can attest, you know, based on what we do on a day-to-day basis, that we're seeing a pretty good increase or a pretty good influx. So I think CLOs are just an indicator, right? And being up, you know, quite a bit, you know, over the last few months is really kind of shedding a light, you know, to a lot of folks who are paying attention.
Yeah. Man, that's a good point. It's the canary in the coal mine, looking at the auto side of it. I've heard that too, but wasn't aware of the stats. Huh. Very interesting.
Yeah. If you pay attention, right? I mean, it's like more than, you know, three million households are more than 30-day behinds. They're talking about the CLOs. You're talking about the auto loan defaults. You're talking about the, you know, the interest rates. You're talking about repossessions. We had the highest amount of business and personal bankruptcy filings in 2023 that we've had since 2010, right? So, that, I mean, that's 13 years later. It's kind of really starting to help those that are looking at this data understand what's going on. And if you are ethical, if you're an ethical operator and you provide solutions and you provide real value to those that you serve, the next 4 to 6 year period is going to be another one of those, you know, transfer of wealth type of situations for those kind of operating in a blue ocean, right? As opposed to the shark infested red waters. I'm here providing solutions. I'm running into the gunfire and taking care of this. And that's really what we're preparing for.
Yeah. 100%. That's why I got into REO and the CDPE. Like, it's coming. We've got some people in our brokerage group that are, you know, they went through 08 as REO agents. They're like, it's coming. It's probably not going to be an 08. We'll see. You know, there's a lot of safeguards in place, but you're
there
saying
are, that, there are. I mean, we like the pre side of things, right? So we like to be on the front side of that and try to provide a loss mitigation solution. I mean, at that point, when we're operating with the institutions, right, we're not negotiating directly with emotional, you know, homeowners and sellers trying to get the most for their property. We're now negotiating with banks and institutions, and they have their black and white rules, regulations, and guidelines. You know exactly how to negotiate with the institutions, and that makes it much easier. The loss mitigation departments at these institutions generally look at somebody who's educated and understands what's going on and knows how to present and have the conversation as somebody on their team. And they would much rather engage in a pre-foreclosure sale or pre-foreclosure solution than actually go through the foreclosure process, the expense of foreclosing, and then taking the property back, real estate owned, if it doesn't sell at auction. And then on the real estate side, REO side of things, I've never been a licensed agent. I've never been on that side, but my business partner, right? He was a large REO broker in the state of Massachusetts, you know, focused on the pre-foreclosure side, but then taking the other side as they come.
Yeah.
The one thing that he talks quite a bit about is the fact that, you know, if you're on the REO side, it's fantastic to get, you know, a file dump of 20 houses that need to be listed in the metro that you're actually operating in. But also when you're REO, you're basically almost on the payroll of the institution that's providing that. And he just talks about the horror stories of, you know, getting calls on Christmas Day and being told to do this and tasks and just literally like,
you are
working for them. And you, if you can't keep up with these tasks and you can't perform the way we need, guess what? There's 10 other people in line for it. So we'd much rather focus on like the pre-foreclosure side and the quality over quantity side of things. So that would be the only warning I think I have on the REO side of things. Is it's going to be good for the getting, you know, with what's coming, but also you gotta, we like to focus on the life by design aspects of things, right? The reason I like to negotiate with banks and institutions is because, hey, they negotiate on 7 to 10 day cycles, and if I don't get to them this afternoon, they'll be there tomorrow. You know, I've got third party authorization. I'm the only one talking with the bank. I don't have to worry about somebody kind of swooping in and taking a deal from me because of all the work that I've done already to this point. Whereas on the other side of things, I'm sitting there, you know, hey, you're just one of five people that are providing me an offer on my home, you know, and when they call you up at, you know, 6:30 on a Friday night when you're out to dinner with your family and say, hey, I need your best offer in the next 15 minutes, you basically got to jump, right? Yeah. You know, it's one of these jump how high type things. When you're working with institutions, you can basically control your day, control your schedule. And if you learn how to actually move it over to a lot of the conversation back and forth is done via email, as opposed to picking up the phone and getting lost in the world of customer service, you know, then you can be pretty efficient at actually going back and forth with an institution. And the email aspect of that is even more important because that's your documentation, that's your history, that's your trail. That's exactly what's being said throughout the entire conversation. So
yeah,
I can bang out 5 emails, you know, at 5 o'clock on a Wednesday morning and be done with those 5 files for the next 10 days. Right.
Yeah. Interesting. You got my wheels turning.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the next one from Benzinga. Big Short Investor is on a rural real estate buying spree in these 3 states. We're talking about Kyle Bass, the guy that was the guy that Michael Lewis focused on in the movie The Big Short.
Right.
So he's says to heed migration trends, specifically towards rural lands in Texas, Florida, and Tennessee. So he's says because of them being pro business and low tax havens. His company is called Conservation Equity Management. They're purchasing large tracts of land, not for development, but for generating environmental credits. Not quite sure. Can you comment on what that really means?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm totally deep into the environmental credits, but obviously that is, you know, when another government program right gets involved, the same states, you know, are coming up on a frequent basis, Florida, Texas, Tennessee, you know, where that migration is going. I think that this is more of a, you know, a long-term appreciation play, right? You can take advantage of some credits that are going on right now for that. But if I just purchase these large tracts of land in a little bit more rural Texas or Florida or Tennessee, you know, and I build that that investment pool or that group to actually back it, then in 10 years, it's more of a long-term play rather than a cash flow play is what's going on and what he's actually seeing. And it makes sense, like the trends of people migrating to these areas. At a certain point, the value of that land is going to go up. And in the meantime, why don't you just take these, you know, these credits that the government is going to give you from an environmental standpoint? So,
yeah, I'd be curious to learn more about that. It says not for development. I don't know if that's accurate. I would assume it is for development just in the future, right? They're getting these tax credits, and maybe those tax credits make up for the fact they're having to hold this with no cash flow. Right. Yeah. Antonio put a comment, environmental credits. Carbon credits are permits that allow a business to emit a certain amount of greenhouse gases. They're also known as carbon offsets. I don't know.
Very niche, right? That's it. Yeah, I mean, that's what anybody should really love about real estate is you can get, you know, as niche as you want.
Yeah.
As long as you make it work for what your needs are.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to mention too, we're going back to that last article we were talking about pre-foreclosure and stuff. If anybody, Rick, have you seen 99 Homes or Antonio?
It's funny. I haven't seen it, but but my mastermind group basically was just told by my partner to watch it.
Yeah. Yeah, same here. I just watched it not too long ago. Man, it's heart-wrenching. It's funny too, because I watched that and I'm like, oh my God, I don't know if I want to work in this space. I don't know if I can handle it. I'm just, you know, I feel too much for people. And, you know, there's also some danger in that, you know, when you're potentially kicking people out of homes and that, you know, there's a lot that goes into that. But I brought it up with another agent that's in our group that has gone through all this. And he's like, oh, you have no idea. Like it's worse. Like some of the stuff that was going on back in 2008, people being taken advantage of and scams and stuff running. He's like, hey, they didn't even nail it.
I'm typically advising on the front side of that. And when I say kind of advising on the front side of that, when you do have a homeowner, or, you know, we tend to refer to them as borrowers because that's what they are in the eyes of the institution. And it's not necessarily a seller, especially if the asset's upside down, they're forced to do something here in this situation. But I just had a lady in the Kansas City area that would pop her head up every once in a while to our communication and I could really use help. And we get in and we start to build the trust and rapport, but had just buried the head in the sand too long and actually went to sheriff's sale last Wednesday. And so we're still trying to provide advice on the back end, right?
Yeah.
She thought it was literally sheriff's sale. I'm going to be thrown to the curb today. Right? And that's not the way it is. But when you start talking about 99 offers and you start talking about the REO side or the investor that actually purchased the property at the sale, now you turn into a true, you know, tenant situation where it's either a cash for keys, the bank's going to try and give cash for keys, or the investor that actually purchased the property is going to try and give cash for keys. So we help the borrowers understand that, you know, you're not going to be thrown out that day. Here's exactly what's going to happen. And in your specific state, you know, in the state of Kansas, there are redemption rights, you know, 3 months up to 12 months, depending on how much of their actual original loan balance that they had paid off. So you instruct through all of that. So I can't imagine. I'm on the front side of that, and I've been told about 99 offers. I can't imagine what the other side of that looks like. That would not be fun.
No. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to help somebody right now avoid that. I was like, go watch that movie. Like that'll wake him up because he's got his head in the sand.
One of my business partner had one of our current cases actually like literally suggested you should go watch 99 Homes.
Yeah.
That was literally the suggestion.
Yeah. Antonio says it actually leaves Netflix on March 31st. So got a couple days to go watch that.
Got to get on it.
Anybody
now.
Wants to go watch that. They got Netflix. So. Let's jump into the next one from United States Real Estate Investor. Shattered era. $418 million settlement shocking real estate industry. Well, here we go. Back into the lawsuit with NAR, National Association of Realtors. Let's see, where should we even start with this? Rick, you got any comments while I read my notes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you were kind of headed down the path that it's going to be interesting with the buyer's agent and the buyer themselves and how they could potentially negotiate on an actual purchase. right? Mm-hmm. You know, if it is, we're not paying the buyer's agent, then it's just going to be like any other concession, right? You know, where, especially if you're talking a you know, government-backed loan, or where we're talking about paying a portion of closing cost or paying a portion of this to handle that, that's just going to become a point of negotiation and transaction. And I do truly believe with the change of you know, what's going on in the retail space and even, you know, traditional real estate investors, that the strong will survive. I think this is exactly the case for the brokers. And I think this is exactly the case for the agents, the honest, the ethical, the ones that are going to put in the work, the ones that are going to show their value are going to continue to operate and even potentially still get, you know, that full 5-6%, you know, based on, you know, working with a seller directly and being able to pull out the value is the big thing, I think, in any of this. So yeah. I'm not too overly worried about it. I think it's going to weed the bad ones out and keep your good, strong, honest, ethical. And it should. I mean, I'm not a licensed agent. I don't knock agents. But just like the logo on my hat says, hone your craft, mm-hmm. right? You know, there are a lot. You know, I don't know how many short sales I pick up from somebody who started a short sale. In fact, I just picked one up not too long ago where the agent had it listed on the market and said, this is my very first real estate transaction ever. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, what did you do in the past? Oh, I was a customer service person for Safelite. I'm like, mm-hmm. this is going to go well. Right. You know? So just because you know, and I'm, you know, not knocking NAR in this particular situation, but you've got that NAR certification that says you're a certified short sale specialist, you know, or whatever it may be, you're like, you have no idea what you're talking about. The CRE and the training that you actually did just basically gave you a designation where you're going to get your real education is working, you know, the short sale or working these pre-foreclosure solutions. So on any side of the coin, as soon as you start to really hone your craft, it's going to weed out the bad and it's going to elevate the good operators.
Yeah. There's so much we could dive into here. I guess I'd just like to point out that some of this will be semantics. There may be some adjustments in how and if and where commissions are advertised or not, how it's getting paid out. Now, the first thing I see buyers, and I kind of touched on this before, buyers being hurt by this. If they've barely got a down payment, they're trying to get a CHAFA loan or something to help with their down payment and closing costs. They don't have enough to pay an agent commission to help them go through that transaction. If they try to go direct to a seller and the listing agent, and they don't have somebody helping them through that process, negotiating on their behalf, which is a huge part of this, and holding their hand through that process, they're at a huge disadvantage. So there's a reason why there's representation on both sides. The other thing, as far as the money goes, there's limits. Lenders have limits to how much a seller can credit a buyer. It's not going to cover all of that. It's
right.
Part of the down payment and closing costs. Maybe I'm not a lender, so I don't know exactly, but you know, it's not going to be the full amount. So, there's going to be some negotiating and sellers will have to kind of understand that on their side too.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something?
Well, I think that you probably see a new school of buyer's agents, right?
Mm-hmm.
People that learn how to adapt and learn how to actually rise to the top and learn how to work with the actual buyers and say, hey, trust me, you know, you want me there doing this for you. And then they've just, you know, it's like anything. You make any of these changes that we're talking about and we all just adapt. And you're definitely going to see that, you know, those that are looking for the low hanging fruit will be gone, period. And those yep. who make a specialty of being a buyer's agent in any of their particular markets and they get good at what they're doing, they're probably going to really soar. Right.
Yep.
So if I'm sitting in the licensed real estate agent's shoes right now, I'm just figuring out exactly how I can provide value.
100%.
I'm figuring out exactly how I can adapt, and I'm just going to put my head down and I'm going to do that. And I'm not going to worry about what happens in July. I'm not going to worry about anything else, because it'll all really start to shake out, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of agents and lenders all leaving the business already, just because this business is, you know, shriveled up. But yeah, it's going to.
Well, let's be real. I mean, how many of the actual 1 million or 1.5 million realtors that are part of that are doing it as a day to day? I mean, you run by so many run of the mill, you know, yeah, realtors that, hey, I got my license to help friends and family, or I got my license to do this. I do one or two transactions a year. I think that's where we're seeing, you know, just even before the NAR settlement, you know, with what was going on in the retail market, you're seeing a lot of people choose not to, you know, the expense of renewing my license and paying my dues and doing all that kind of stuff. They were going away anyway, right? Yeah. So it's only going to further weed those type of folks out and you know, work with folks in the industry that actually are doing this every day as their real full-time income. The other thing is at least for now, maybe the banks or institutions will eventually, you know, catch on to the settlement. I don't think they really care what's going on with the settlement, but they have absolutely no problem, right, paying a licensed agent, you know, the full 6%, you know, or if there's just a single side, maybe 4.5%. But the institutions require licensed agents to be part of the transaction. So I think there are agents out there that will start to adapt, especially with the way the economy is going. They will start to adapt and go, hey, if I focus on and become a pre-foreclosure expert in this area, or I learn how to identify the regular, you know, day-to-day listings that most agents don't want, you know, that would turn it over. There's no equity, low equity. There's, it's only a month or less before it actually goes to sale, or just things they can't provide solutions to. You're going to have more agents that figure out how to do that when we're talking hybrid, you know, yep, investor agents. I think that will become a little bit more common as well. But the institutions, we've got realtors in our network that make, you know, six figures from doing nothing but listing short sales, right? Yep. And we do all of the heavy lifting, you know, right? We do all of the negotiations. We work the banks and the institutions, and the real estate agent just does what they do, the listing agreements, all the disclosures, everything else, because these institutions are happy to pay that as part of the transaction, because just like they hire a local foreclosing attorney, mm-hmm, because that foreclosing attorney knows the laws and the regulations, the rules, and everything within the specific county or jurisdiction. You know, a Freedom Mortgage, a Carrington Mortgage, an SLS, they can't know that for all 50 states, even though they operate in those states. Same thing, right? They're willing to pay a certified, you know, licensed realtor, right, that has an ethical duty to do everything to the laws of the local municipality and state. So that's an area where I think you could potentially see some agents move to, is we know what's coming, provide solutions. The institutions aren't going to negotiate with me. They're just going to pay it.
Yeah, great point. Back to what you had said about this kind of shaking out. I think it's, you know, the top 5% of realtors are actually full-time, actually making a living wage, you know. Most people are part-time. They don't know what they're doing. They're just doing a couple transactions here and there. They can't make a living out of it. It's a huge gap between those top ones. Right. And those are the ones that are going to be able to show their value to a buyer and stay in the game and actually help people. The other thing I wanted to point out too, like people are saying, oh, there's going to be all these discount buyer brokerage situations. There always have been. There's always somebody that's willing to like take the dive to the bottom, you know. But the problem with that is you get what you pay for, right? It always comes back to that. You might pay them 1% or something. Well, you know, maybe on the listing side they just put a sign in your yard and they don't promote your property. On the buy side, they're not going to really help you negotiate and be that fiduciary that they're supposed to.
There's no marketing plan on that side. They literally stick the sign in the ground and they throw it on the MLS and that's it.
Yep. Happens all the time. Yep. People sometimes don't realize that how much they've missed out on. You know, they think, oh, I got a good deal. You know, I sold my house. I didn't pay much in this commission. Well, shoot, they could have got way more to make up for it. In fact, you know, NAR has stats on for sale by owners versus selling with an agent. And it just over time, most people make way more than those commissions that they would have paid anyway. So,
yep. Yeah. No, that makes total sense.
Yeah. I go on my soapbox on that. Let's get into our last extra news item. This is a fun one. From Upworthy, millennials and Gen Z ditched top sheets, much to the dismay of older generations. Who's right? They're talking about top sheets for your bed versus duvet covers. It's funny because I have a friend that does that. She's no millennial. She's in her 50s, like my age. But I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. I like that idea of, you know, one less sheet. Keeps it simple.
Yeah. I dug into the article a little bit, and it just talked about, you know, like separating like your body from the actual comforter and providing that layer so your comforter stayed cleaner. And that's the whole premise behind, you know, having something that's easy to wash, like a duvet cover, or that you just throw, it's cheap and you don't care about it and you throw it in. And I just, you know, scratch my head, you know, when it comes to this, you're like, well, what, from generation to generation, why does any generation do anything that they do? And then the older generation typically looks at the younger generation and says, why? You know, why would you do this, or why would you be that way? You know, coming from the, you know, the Gen X world, you know, I don't know that I necessarily have a preference, right? You know, I mean, we have a top sheet and a comforter, but I oftentimes find myself with the top sheet gone because I'm a radiator, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's too hot, you know, or vice versa, throw the comforter off and just have the top sheet on.
Exactly.
So I didn't really look at it as, you know, keeping the comforter clean, right? Where the article talks about it. I thought that was kind of funny, you know, as to why it was there. So
yeah,
I don't know, maybe the millennials are onto something.
Yeah, you can wash a duvet cover. They talked about that, right? As frequently as your top sheet. But I know I found, because I had a duvet cover in the past with the, you know, feather.
The downfill.
Downfilled. Yeah. It was so hot. I hated taking it off was fine, but putting it back on. Was annoying, trying to get the corners in. So like I would actually like get inside of it with the down thing and get it up into the corners. This is annoying. I'd rather just
well, wash and I also think times have changed too, right? You know, I mean, back, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, comforters were big, heavy, quilted, heavy things, right, that you didn't want to wash that often. And you know, I'm thinking about the last couple of comforters that we've had have been not duvet covers, but they've been very lightweight and very easy to manage. I mean, still warm from that perspective, but something that you didn't mind washing or laundering, right?
Yeah. All right, well, that was a fun one. That's our last news item for the month. I'd like to thank our sponsors, my company, Hybrid Real Estate Investing, and Universe Media Publishing, and United States Real Estate Investing. And of course, thanks to our guest, Michael Margarella, who had to drop out. I should have let people know he had to drop out early. And Rick Hamrick. Thanks, Rick. Appreciate you sharing your knowledge and time, man. You were a great guest.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Rick, why don't you let people know how they can connect with you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you just go to our website, www.ipaforrei.com, you can learn a lot more about me there, or at Rick, R-I-C-K, Hamrick, HAMRICK.info. That'll allow you to get in contact with me as well.
All right, great. I'm going to reach out to you for sure.
Looking forward to it.
Appreciate you. I'm your host, James Brown. I show people how to make safe, secure returns through our unique time-tested hybrid investing model, as well as, like I mentioned before, you know, we raise money for multifamily, self-storage, syndications. So go to hybridinvestor.vip to learn more. And again, add the www if it doesn't pop up for you. Also, thanks for helping out and coming up with the idea for this show from our producer, Antonio Holman, in the background. And follow and subscribe to This Month in Real Estate Investing on YouTube at youtube.com/@UnitedStatesREI or your favorite podcast app. And if you run across any interesting news, events, or good guest suggestions, like Rick, Rockstar, feel free to share by emailing Antonio@UnitedStatesRealEstateInvestor.com. And remember, when one door closes, another door opens to financial freedom. Thanks, everybody.